Family, domestic and sexual violence has been a national focus in recent years. Greater media scrutiny of the rising number of Australian women dying at the hands of their current or former partners has fueled community demands for change. The latest figures reveal that one in four Australian women have experienced physical or sexual violence committed by a current or former partner since the age of 15. And in Queensland alone, police are responding on average to as many as 400 cases of domestic violence every day. And the numbers are worse for First Nations women, with the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare finding that cohort the most at-risk group in the country to be impacted by domestic violence. Sandra Creamer is a one-year Kalkadoon woman, lawyer and CEO of the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Women's Alliance and a domestic violence survivor. Sandra, it's such a privilege to have you with us this evening. Welcome to Speaking Out.
Thank you, Larissa.
I'd love to begin by getting just to know a little bit more about you so we can understand better who you are. Can you tell us where you grew up?
I'm Kalkadoon Wanyi. I grew up in Mount Isa and I spent many of my childhood days out in Camberwell. There's 12 in my family. I've got three sisters and seven brothers. And yes, my father worked out on a station all his life and my mother passed away when I was young. So we were raised in a really big family environment with my aunties and uncles, and they lived out in Camberwell. So between Mount Isa and Camberwell, I had my growing up life.
So, Sandra, it sounds like you had a really great big family, but I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about how that shaped your worldview, or what did shape your worldview?
I think that foundation did shape my worldview because we really had a lot of love in that family and we really had a lot of values and morals. And when you come from a big family, of course, there's always going to be arguments and debates, but my father really made us sit down every night and had dinner together, and we had to really put a lot of bygones aside and just continue on. So we learned in life, you know, don't hold the grudge and don't have conflicts with each other, but also about that foundation of being strong in a family and understanding also where we came from and about that kinship relationship. So that really laid down a strong foundation for me. I think it gave me my resilience too, because my father worked out on a station. We didn't have too much food or anything as we were growing up. But it's that resilience of who you are, the strength of who you are, the identity, and having that connection to going out to the bush and water holes all of the time. But as well as knowing that we're strong, a strong family, we're a strong group of people and a strong individual.
For the benefit of our listeners who aren't aware of it, what is the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Women's Alliance?
The National Aboriginal Women's Alliance, we really try and work with women on the ground and look at what their issues are and advocate for what they really want. So we've written quite a few submissions. If you go onto our sites, you'll see the submissions that we've written to the Special Rapporteur to when there's changes in legislations, and we try and advocate in different ways, many different ways for our women. And to us, it's not all about domestic violence, but it's also empowering our women and making sure that they have the right information to what they need to grow as an individual and to empower themselves, their family and their communities.
Are you able to share with us a picture of what your personal experience was with domestic and family violence?
Yeah, it was really difficult because I didn't really say anything to my family for quite a while. It was not easy because you have that cohesive control as well. And at that time, you don't really know what it is. But then there was a lot of physical violence and everything like that. And I think that I remember, you know, when I was pregnant with my third child, I really, you know, got dragged around the house. And I thought, oh, I really have to do something and leave. But at that time, I felt a bit embarrassed, I think, because in those days, it's like you stay with that person that you married and everything like that. But my brother found out, and he was so good. His wife told him, actually, his partner told him, because one night I ran away and I went to her house to stay with my children. It was just a one night, and she told my brother said to me the next day, you need to leave. He said, I'll do whatever I can to help you to leave. He's always been by myself and been very supportive of that, as with the rest of my family. But it was really, you have really dark days because I was in that situation for quite a while. And then at that time, I really didn't have an education, didn't have any jobs, and I wanted to leave. And then I jumped from the frying pan into the fire, and it was just really dark days for me. I can't express how hard it was. And mentally, when you're coming from that sort of environment and you live it for quite a few years, it's really, really difficult to overcome. But I got good counselling, and I felt that I really need to make a change in myself, because the anger that they inflict in you and everything and the hurt and the brokenness, it carries with you. It doesn't change overnight. And I found that I had that in me, but I didn't want to be like that to my children. And one of my children said to me, oh, Mum, this isn't really you. And I thought, no, it isn't me. I really need to make a change. And so I did. And as a family, we were really able to, I've been able to heal myself and then talk through my children and discuss things with them. And we really all have an open relationship, but it has to be like that because they witnessed a lot of things. They seen a lot of things, and it was a difficult life for them because we were here by ourselves, and we really had at times no electricity on. I remember having my car repossessed once, and, you know, we were just eating bread and tomato and onion gravy at times. And I thought, you know, I just need to really, really get help. And it was all through that process of giving help that I was able to have confidence in myself to go and get a job, to be able to talk to people and to be able to change myself. So it doesn't happen overnight. It took quite a number of years to do.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that story with us. It's so important to hear such remarkable stories so that we can better understand what it's like. So it's a very generous thing for you to do, but it's also very inspirational to see where you've come to. Because you've had such personal experience in this field and now you're there on the ground helping others, from your perspective, are there adequate resources currently for community-led services to support victims fleeing domestic violence?
No, there isn't, Larissa. There's none at all. And I feel one of the big things that they did take away was the victims of crime support in the courthouse. When they used to have a victims of crime set up in every courthouse, I think that they were quite good, especially for women who are in domestic violence or any children who were going through any child abuse or anything. They were a good system. And then what happened then is they changed the victims of crime compensation around Australia. There's all different processes for that, and that's all run through the courts. So that all changed. And then so when you have people out in remote communities who especially were going to court, and women who were going to court, and they didn't have anyone there and they didn't have that victims of crime support that was set up to be in the courts, that was one of the biggest failures of all. And then out in the remote communities where there's very limited resources, English, as we know, on some of these communities is not the first language. So there's a breakdown of language barriers, there's a breakdown of understanding the court process, and there's hardly any places where the women can go for domestic violence. There are women's shelters on some of the communities, but some of these communities are small communities where there's only maybe about five or six houses on some remote, very remote communities, on town camps or anything like that. So they don't have those resources. They have to go into larger town areas to get that. So there's very limited resources. I think even in the cities, there's, like I said, the victims of crime has been taken away. There's limited resources for women's shelters, limited resources for women who want to have counselling. There should be all different kinds of counselling services that's happening, but no, all of those things, there's very limited.
One of the things you mentioned about your own experience was the use of coercive control against you. The Queensland government's now proposing to introduce laws that make coercive control illegal. What are your thoughts on the proposal? Do you think that that's a way of addressing the issue?
Well, it is a really serious matter. It is very serious. Some women are living that life and they don't even know it. I think one of the things is that something needs to be done to make women safe. I'm not quite sure whether that's the answer of making it legal. Well, maybe it should be, but what happens in the end is I think that you have domestic violence order, and as many things as you put in and legislate them, there's no help for the men, and it's them who need that help because they're so controlling. So when there's domestic violence orders that are in place, one of the things that I believe, and this is my own personal opinion, is that they should have counselling service immediately, mandatory counselling service for these men for at least 6 to 1 year, so that they can learn to change their behaviours, and that they need to then be accountable and identify where they need to make those changes and how they need to be able to address it. Because the sad thing is that I've had a lady write to me about how badly treated and what this person done to her animals, just to put that fear in them. And that's the thing. It can just really put a lot of fear into people, and it just doesn't affect the individual themselves. It can also affect everybody in the house and then some other members of the family who don't even live in the house, or friends or anything. It's just that fear that people can put in just by their actions and their behaviour.
You've already mentioned some of the things that are issues in the area you're working in, but what other things do you think can be done or also need to be done to improve the situation for First Nations women and families?
I think one of the other things that can happen, and I've actually, my daughter fosters children and she has 4 foster children. And what happened is that she got asked if she could have another baby. And so that would have been 5 children under 4 years of age that she would have had. And she said, "Mum, I can't do it." She said, "It's very hard for me. I'm working and I'm trying to study, and my partner and I, we love the little ones, but it would have made 8 children altogether." So what I did was I phoned the hospital here, and the board member of the Rockhampton Hospital, Leanne Wilson, and I said to her, "Leanne, we must do something. The other issue that is missing with our women is reproductive health, because women are so traumatised, they're getting their children removed each time. You know, it's traumatising these women, and in serious situations, they don't know what to do." And I think that, so we contacted the hospital together. The hospital have now are working with us on looking at putting contraceptives in the maternity hospital here. We're working with them at the moment so that they have the names of all contraceptives that are available for women, and that those women who are specifically in domestic violence or having their children removed, it is the only safe space for them to say, "I want to be able to have some sort of contraceptives. Can you help me?" We're also working with a lot of women with Westpac and Marawa Law in doing e-leader business training. And a lot of our women out there are becoming business owners, and they want to be able to get themselves into ownership of businesses on their communities or within their families. And we've had quite a few women who were single mothers. They share their stories at these workshops and tell us how things are affecting them and what they're looking for in the future. And a lot of them are saying, "Well, we just want to be able to get out of poverty and make money, and we want to be able to do the different things, and we want to make sure that we're creating some sort of employment for our children or our families or our communities." So they're the 3 big things that we're actually working on at the moment.
Well, you are an inspiration in so many ways. Thank you for the work that you're doing on the ground, that really important work. And thank you for spending some time with us this evening on Speaking Out.
Yeah, thank you very much, Larissa. I really appreciate it.
The remarkable Sandra Creamer is the CEO of the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Women's Alliance and a domestic violence survivor. And if you or anyone you know is experiencing difficulty, you can call 1-800-RESPECT. That's 1-800-737-732.